From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's been nearly 17 years since Brooklyn, New York's Crown Heights neighborhood was engulfed by riots and recriminations. The neighborhood is a mix of Caribbean Americans, Black Americans born in the States, and Orthodox Jews. In August of 1991, a rabbi's motorcade hit a 7-year-old Guyanese boy named Gavin Cato. He later died from his injuries. Some neighbors believe that a Jewish ambulance crew that arrived slightly before the city ambulance should have taken Cato to the hospital. Within hours of the boy's death, a mob of young Black men killed Yankel Rosenbaum, a young Orthodox Jewish divinity student. Stores were looted or burned, and dozens of people were injured in the subsequent days. Flash forward to the present. In the last few weeks, a series of new incidents, admittedly much smaller ones, have put Crown Heights on a slow boil. Can members of the Black and Jewish communities ease the tensions, and are they willing to try? In a few minutes, we'll hear from two of those community leaders. But first, here to help us untangle the latest Crown Heights affair is New York Post editorial writer Robert George. Hi, Robert.
Hey, Farai. How's it going?
Good. And why don't we talk about this in context? You know, you have the 1991 tensions that broke out. Now, what exactly is going on today?
Well, right now, you had a series of sort of minor incidents of either involving Black on Jewish black perpetrators on Jewish victims, or Jewish perpetrators on Black victims, and a lot of it. I mean, if you look at it from, you kind of step back, particularly in the context of 91, it's almost laughable in certain ways that people are making a comparison, because a lot of these have to do with like sort of stealing of bicycles, and they seem to be kinds of crimes of opportunity as opposed to specifically racial or ethnic bias. One of the first incidents you had was more generic, where some African Americans beat up African Americans beat up a young Jewish boy. Then you had a case where the son, actually, of NYPD detective, African American, was jumped by a group of young Jewish men who may or may not have been affiliated with a Jewish community patrol unit called the Shmira, and that they feel that one of the people who was involved in it is a member of that. Then some African American boys saw a Jewish kid on a bicycle and jumped him and stole the bike. So there's this certain kind of a back and forth, but it's really important to keep in mind that the incidents of 1991 were in a context where there had been really long simmering tensions between the Black community and the Orthodox Jewish community. Many of the African Americans were feeling that there was not just bias within the Jewish community towards Blacks, but that the broader city power structure was siding with the Jewish community and ignoring some of the complaints of Blacks. So that was kind of the gasoline that had a match spark to it that kind of exploded in the riots in 91.
Now, former Mayor David Dinkins and the NYPD got criticized for their handling of the riots back in 1991. How has Mayor Bloomberg been doing, and Police Commissioner Kelly?
Well, arguably the reason why David Dinkins became a one-term mayor was because of what happened in 91, particularly the fact that these riots went on for 3 days, and the police were apparently ordered not to go in and stop it, and there was this feeling that it became one of the symbols of the city being out of control. So far, both Mayor Bloomberg and Commissioner Kelly have not been really facing that much criticism. I mean, the irony is actually back in '91, there were each group, the blacks on one side and the Jews on the other, were claiming that the city was favoring the other side. This time, if there's any kind of criticism, it's that both sides are saying that the city isn't doing enough to find out who the perpetrators are, because so far no one has actually been arrested in any of these incidents, even though suspicion has fallen on, as I said, as a member of one of the Jewish community patrol groups. So to that extent, there's not really much of there's frustration that there haven't been some arrests, but there so far there doesn't seem to be this belief that the city isn't taking this seriously, or B, that they're completely and totally in the tank for the other community.
Thanks for the update, Robert.
Thank you.
Robert George is an editorial writer for the New York Post, and he joined us from our NPR studios in New York City. Now we're going to continue the conversation about Crown Heights with two community leaders. Richard Green is the founder of the Crown Heights Youth Collective, and Yossi Stern is the leader of the Shmira, a Jewish Orthodox neighborhood patrol in Crown Heights. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome. Peace.
So, Yossi, let me start with you. We were just hearing from Robert George, who's an editor at the New York Post, and he mentioned your group, the Shmira, which is involved in this in the sense that some people, including some people in the police department, think that one of your members might have been involved in one of the attacks. How are you going about talking to your members, and do you believe one of your members was involved in the attack on the son of the police officer?
The first thing is that I don't know for a fact who was involved in this attack. Secondly, I do know that there is a person of interest that they do want to talk to, and he is a member of our patrol. He's also a member of the NYPD auxiliary force, and we all know who he is. He's a nice kid lives in the neighborhood. If, in fact, he was involved in this situation, then he should be punished if there was a crime committed. The Crown Heights Shmira clearly does not condone violence of any sort to anyone. We are only the eyes and ears for the police. We act as a passive patrol, and we've been doing so for 40 years. We have hundreds of members that volunteer in patrolling the streets or responding to our hotline to all sorts of domestic situations and emergencies. We assist with the police in many situations, and proof that we work within the confines of the law is that there are no statistics of Shmira being arrested every day for getting into all sorts of activity that might be breaking the law. We don't do that, and the police don't have can tell you that. No, they don't arrest Shmira members, and we're out in the streets in the midst of trouble every day of the week, and we've been doing that for 40 years. Here is one incident. It's an ugly incident where a Jew is being charged for hitting a black boy, and that has to be addressed, not in the media. It should be addressed in the courts of New York, and each side should have their day in court and resolve the issue. And whoever committed a crime, whether it's a black boy or whether it's a Jewish boy, that person must be punished, clearly.
Richard, you know, that sounds like great advice. Everyone must be punished if they commit a crime. How are things actually playing out in Crown Heights, in your opinion?
Well, I think things in Crown Heights are playing itself out accordingly, to the sense that we are always looking to continue to keep an established, lawful, and peaceful community. And I think that's the currency that we all sort of go after. Now, there's a willingness on the part of the community now to get this thing out in the open, have emotions dealt with, and then move on to better things that we want to do. As far as we're concerned, two things. I understood that one said there has not been an arrest. There was an arrest in the case of the young man, Alon Sherman, who was assaulted allegedly by two young men. They have been arrested. That was sometime last week. Now, the other incident in which the alleged member of Shmira was being talked about, that incident, there was a big article in the newspaper that stated clearly that the culture does not allow for a member of the community to be turned over to the authorities accordingly. Now, Yossi and I go back for a while, and Yossi can maybe clarify that for your listeners, that this has been the sense that, and I think Aaron Charles's mother and father and the other members of our community have a deep concern for that because of the fact that there was a serious crime committed, serious enough that the Brooklyn District Attorney Charles Hines impaneled a grand jury to hear testimony regarding this incident.
And so, let me just say that the district attorney also told Jewish Week, you can't have a group, whether it's the Bloods, Crips, or Shmira, acting like vigilantes. Yossi, how do you react to that kind of comparison?
I think it is shocking and appalling for a very wise man such as the district attorney of Brooklyn, who many look up to and respect, to align an organization that has been around for 40 years with its entire mission is to help the community. As everyone in the community knows, the Black community and the Jewish community, to align that with a criminal enterprise such as the Bloods and the Crips. It is unfortunate that he made that statement. I know he did make a retraction subsequent to that statement, but it's not enough. And we hope that he would correct himself and ensure that if he is given information that is verified and not just come out and mudsling an organization that's been doing so much good work. I just want to say we have received awards and recognition from the state attorney general, local politicians, and many financial institutions for our work over the years. It's ridiculous to think to align the Shmira organization with a gang that commits its interest is to commit violence.
Yossi, but and I go back long enough to know Shmira's works in the community and going back to many, many years. But at the same time, it's evident right now that there's a need on the part of the community to be able to sit down in faith and attempt to revamp the way that the Shmira group and the other group, Shoreham, look at our community, because the existing sense in our community, and I'll be very blunt about it, is that it's a group that's primarily focused on young Black and brown males.
Now, gentlemen, I'm sorry, I have to jump in, but you guys are going to stick around with us. I want to thank you very much. We're talking about Crown Heights with Yossi Stern and Richard Green. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're continuing our conversation about tensions in Crown Heights with Richard Green, the founder of the Crown Heights Youth Collective, and Yossi Stern. He is the leader of the Shmira, a Jewish Orthodox neighborhood patrol in Crown Heights. Now, where we broke off, Richard, you were making a point that it sounds like you think Shmira has been targeting Black and brown kids.
Well, I'm saying that to say that this is the general sentiment in the community, and I'm talking about even parents have brought that to my attention on even the younger children. And I think it's something that, as I said earlier, I know Yossi's works, and I respect him. And I think that now is a good time for us to look at this and try to figure out a way that we could sort of redo that image and have some sort of way. I've recommended that we join in a community watch. I would prefer the word watch as opposed to a community patrol. And use that watch group to maybe at some time do some combined action groups where we could look at with each other and see how we could get that perception out of the minds of the community at large. And if that can happen, then out of this tragedy, we could see something good coming out in terms of us being able to go on from this day forth and make something good happen in this community of ours that we both love and live in.
Yossi, how could you make that happen? How could you conceive of a partnership with other groups that would be beneficial to everyone?
First, I want to say is that I also acknowledge, I know Richard for a long time, he's done great work and made unbelievable strides in the community. And everyone in the Jewish community and the Black community definitely supports and respects Richard for all of his work. I just want to bring up three things. Number one, I'm a very big advocate for a joint patrol. I strongly believe that members of a community who will patrol a community should have the makeup within the organization that is representative of the community it is watching. I am all for a joint patrol between the black community and the Jewish community. When I became director in 99, it was one of the first initiatives I attempted to establish, and I had a lot of obstacles from leadership. We were not ready for it, and people thought they would be uncomfortable. But I have made several attempts over the years, and sometimes it worked out for a little bit, and then it would fall apart. I am definitely all for a joint patrol. I'm putting down an open offer. Anytime the community leaders, Richard, or the politicians want to get together, I know Senator Eric Adams has called us and wants to initiate a joint patrol, and we will definitely look into it and make it happen. I am the first advocate for that. Number two I want to say is that it's very important with all that's happening in Crown Heights to really understand the problem at hand. Number one, this is the way I personally see it. The black community, the homeowners, the businessmen, the parents, the working class in the black community and in the Jewish community do not have a problem. We all live harmoniously together. Where there is no fighting, there is no cursing on the streets or any of that nature. The problem is twofold. Number one, it's youth on the street, whether it's gangs or Jewish boys, who fight with each other, whether because they are boys or whether they're part of a gang or they're into violence, whatever it is. That's what it is. It's not the families. It's not the thousands of people that live at home. And the articles and all the hysteria going on about this should not turn it into a whole racial divide that the Crown Heights is up in flames again. God
forbid.
Well,
that's what I'm saying, Yossi, that we need to do things like I talk about a mutual exchange where these young men begin to look at business, look at entrepreneurship programs. We look at an empty lot on the corner of Albany Avenue, get a community garden there where we could also use that for information and knowledge for the general community. And then the other factor in it, I always say, as an old commander used to say, in Crown Heights, there's blacks, blues, and Jews. We have to also figure out a way to sit down and incorporate the police department, which the 77th and the 71st precinct, where we can begin to work as a tandem, as a team with them, and not as a sort of an opposing group of people.
The second thing I want to say is understanding the problem on the street is the complaint by the Jewish community and by the black community to the police or to the DA that they're not doing enough. Everyone is very fortunate that the DA is putting his foot down and is aggressively pursuing the Charles incident, which is an unfortunate incident. What the Jewish community wants to know, and I have in front of me 32 documented cases from May 17th, 08 to February 6th, 06 that we have, and I have a lot more, but I have in front of me just 32, of physical violent assaults from black young men on Jewish young men.
Yossi, but be very clear. You're talking about criminal activity that takes place in all communities. You're not talking about, we want to be clear that it's not necessarily bias attacks, and
gentlemen,
I want to be very, very...
Gentlemen, let me interrupt, gentlemen. We are running out of time, and I just want to, I want to leave on a note of what steps go on from here. Both of you have talked about the idea of whether they're joint patrols or ways of communicating better, and this is going to have to be quick. Richard, what specifically would you like to see?
I'd like to see some mutual exchange programs going between the two communities, us having to sit down and just rediscover what we did back in 1991 that brought us to this day right now. And I think we could reach that aim and that end by just sitting down and having some good dialogue.
Yossi?
I'll add to that and agree with Richard, and I want to just say that in any community, when people are not informed, they become misinformed, and I invite anyone in the black community to contact. You can contact me. My number is 917-709-1404. We can set up a meeting, and we can introduce the other communities into the Crown Heights Patrol and learn how we operate, look what we do, and we're not out targeting any specific race or color or any particular people. We're simply out there to protect the streets of Crown Heights from any element of crime. And Richard, I would invite you to call me. I'll call you. I know Eric Adams wants to work with us on this. And if you're willing to build a coalition, I'll be a part of it. You'll be a part of it. And we could actually take the first step to make a change and make our community happier and safer.
No, I think the city mothers and fathers and the state and feds should step in now and let's make that a reality.
Richard, before we let you go, I actually meant to ask about this earlier, but some of the work that you have done with the Youth Collective is trying to address the underlying issues of poverty and, you know, basically lack of a pathway to success. Just very quickly, tell me what you're trying to do with that.
Well, this is our 31st year working out here with these young people in Brooklyn Central. Just started developing themselves to the point where we're like the middle relief pitchers. We just want to get them to the ninth inning where they can get out there and go for themselves. And that's what we've been doing. We've done a lot of economics. We've done a lot of education. In fact, I just left off doing some things with one of the middle schools. We do things all over this community to just try to give, and it goes well for the Jewish community also. I've had young Jewish young people coming into my center and offering services to them.
I actually sent over a couple of my tenants to you.
Yes. They do come.
Yeah, to look for guidance and a path to success. So,
by the way, are you the
work.
Author of a book that we used many years ago, The Commentator?
I'm sorry.
Are you the writer of a book? I know your name.
Yes. I've written a few books.
Don't believe the hype.
Yes, I am.
Oh, wow. Good to hear from you again.
Well, thank you.
I have a copy that we use it a lot. I use a lot of it when I speak to young people in the schools.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, on that note, I do appreciate it, and I want to say, Yossi and Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All the best, Yossi.
Yossi Stern is the leader of the Shmira, a Jewish Orthodox neighborhood patrol group in Crown Heights, and Richard Green is the founder of the Crown Heights Youth Collective. There are 1.5 million prisoners living behind bars in the United States. More than half of them are parents. What happens to the children once their parents are incarcerated, and what happens to the adults on the inside? How can you keep a family connected? In a few minutes, we'll talk to author Nell Bernstein. She wrote the book All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. But right now, we have Teresa Roxanne Cruz and her daughter Antoinette Rangel. Teresa spent 15 years in prison. Antoinette was 9 years old when Teresa was sent to prison in 1991. So, Teresa and Antoinette, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
So, Teresa, tell us just quickly why you were sent to prison.
Well, I was a long custody battle with my common law husband. We weren't married, but we had lived together, and he had stalked me and broken into 5 of my homes and stole all of my belongings, and he had physically abused me, and I had police reports of it. But the crime happened behind a custody battle, and that was where I just crashed in, and I was supposed to give him my son the following day, and he was 5 years old, and we had a long custody battle, and I tried to kill him the night before I had to give him my son, and he was shot 47 times. I was not the actual shooter. I was in the car when it happened, and I was addicted to Xanax. I was on 300 pills a month now of Xanax, so my life was completely unmanageable by that time.
Antoinette, do you remember feeling like your family was out of control, even before your mother was arrested?
No. I was actually too little to remember. Things were actually out of control. We had a very stable home. The only thing I remember is moving a lot, seeing a lot of different homes, going to a lot of different schools, but I really wasn't aware of exactly what was going on.
And when your mom went to prison, what did that mean to you? I mean, how did, in your child's mind, what did it mean to you?
Being a child, having your mom taken away from you is something very hard. I felt, even though I had my grandmother taking care of me, I felt alone, embarrassed. In school, a lot of kids, there's a lot of activities. I played a lot of sports, and my parents were just, my mom was never around, and I was just more embarrassed and kind of depressed as a child. Now that I look back, that I'm older, of how depressed I was as a kid.
Teresa, you had four children, and your mother took care of them all. What did it take? How did you communicate with your mother about saying, well, I want this for the kids, but knowing that you couldn't be there to enforce it? And your mother sounds like an amazing woman. How did you two get along, though, during that time that you were incarcerated?
It was hard. I would hear the kids gripe about, you know, how old-fashioned grandma was, and my mom was real protective of them. She had my grandmother drive them to school and pick them up. My grandmother retired from Kaiser and moved in with my mother while my mother worked at Lockheed. She had 26 years at Lockheed. But they both faithfully came every weekend to see me. They drove 2.5 hours and waited 2.5 hours in line and came in. So I had a very, very united family in that visiting room, something that you very rarely see. And at that time, time they had family flu visits. So my mother would, the officer would tell me, Teresa, do you want this flu visit? There's a cancellation. And I would say, yeah. And I would call my mom at work, and she would say, okay, let me call mama and tell her to come by and get a check, and she can go with the kids. So they would come stay for 3 days. And they took away those visits eventually because of people, you know, having kids in prison and that. And I think that it would have been great. I mean, I don't wouldn't have cared if they would have taken away for sexual reasons, but they should have never taken away for the children, because they used to go and take their homework, and we used to have time, and it really wasn't about us, because I used to cry my eyes out when they left from guilt and shame and failure. It was really about them.
So during those visits, the children could actually stay overnight in the prison?
Yes, and then they took them away for lifers.
You know, Antoinette, did you ever do those overnight visits?
Yeah, actually, I look forward to those visits. I believe we used to go about every 3 months, and we used to stay for about three nights and 4 days. And I think I was a little bit older when I started going on the flu visits with my mom, and I actually really looked forward to them because my grandmother was so old-fashioned that there was no time to talk about what I was going through at the age or how I was feeling. So my mom, that was a lot of time for me to spend with my mom, even though it was just 4 days. It was a lot for me.
It sounds like even though your mother was in prison and you had some very specific things that you had to deal with in terms of how and when you saw her, that she was still very much your mother to you.
Oh, yes. Before she went to prison, she was very involved with us. We were in basketball, cheerleading, softball, and when she left, that was all taken away from me because my grandmother, like I said again, she's very old-fashioned and she was very tired and stressed and already raised her kids. So there was really no time for us. And when we did join sports and stuff, it's just she never staged, never went to none of our games. She would just drop us off. And I would try to tell my mom, you know, that I want her to go, but my grandma never really understood me when I was little and what I was going through and how I was feeling because she was going through her own problems.
She probably was so stressed out. I mean, do you have now in retrospect, can you understand more about what she probably was going through?
Oh, yes. I can't even imagine now that I'm a mother and I have two boys and I'm 27 years old. I can't even imagine just with the little stress that I deal with in my life right now. I can only imagine what my grandmother was thinking and what she was going through. And when I look back, I totally understand.
No.
I also, at the same time, I feel like there was more support around me as far as, you know, close friends and stuff like that and more programs that I could have been involved in.
I want to bring in, quickly, Nell Bernstein, who wrote the book All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated. Now, Nell, you actually spoke with Teresa and Antoinette, and Are you happy that they now seem to have a relationship still after all they've been through?
A relationship with
a mother-daughter relationship.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there were very few happy endings in my book, but Teresa's release for prison, which happened after my book was published, was one of the great miracles, and I got to meet her briefly. I didn't get to hear your interview with them just now, but I don't think there was any question that they were going to have a relationship with her because they always had a relationship with her. And that was what I heard from most of the kids that I interviewed, that just because a parent was in prison doesn't mean that that person isn't your parent and that that relationship doesn't continue.
Well, we're going to talk to you more after a break. And before we go, though, Teresa, now that you've reached the other side, you went in, spent 15 years, and you're out. What kind of relationships do you have now with your kids?
Well, I have a beautiful relationship now. When I first got out, it was kind of hard. I thought that I knew my kids and everything, but I really didn't. I had to accept that I had lost 15 years of being a mother. And today, one day I just cried, and I just said, you know, God, I'm just going to let go and let God and just take it one day at a time. And slowly everything started coming together, and I have a beautiful relationship with my kids. I can say that I probably now have the mother and daughter relationship that I had before I went in.
Antoinette, how do you feel?
I feel that we do have a strong relationship. Everything's great. It did take a while for her to kind of understand that I was older and I make my own decisions in my life now. And I feel like I'm making up those 16 years now that I didn't have her around, and it's great.
Well, Teresa and Antoinette, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Thank you.
Thank you so
much. Thank you.
And Nell, stay with us. We're going to come back with you after a break. We were speaking with Teresa Cruz and her daughter, Antoinette Rangel, of San Diego, California. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. How does having a parent in prison impact children, and how does being separated from those children affect incarcerated parents? We're continuing our conversation with Nell Bernstein. She wrote the book All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated, and she's also the coordinator for San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents. Also with us, Kara Gotch. She's the advocacy director at the Sentencing Project, which focuses on criminal justice policy. Nell, welcome back. Kara, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So we just heard from Teresa Cruz and her daughter, Antoinette Rangel. They had something of a relationship during Teresa's 15 years in prison and seemed to have really caught up on their time. So, Kara, give us a sense of what different policies are that might affect parents' abilities to parent from behind bars.
Well, probably one of the biggest obstacles for people who are incarcerated and have children is the reform passed in 1997 called the Adoption Safe Families Act. Under that act, states can terminate parental rights for parents who have a child in foster care for 15 months of 20 consecutively of 15 months over a period of 22 months. Now, if you look at the average sentence of someone who's incarcerated, that certainly exceeds 22 months. So if a parent in prison has to rely on the public welfare system or the child welfare system to care for their child, they have a distinct risk of losing their parental rights.
Nell, how do you see this playing out in terms of parental rights?
Well, ASFA is a huge issue. Women in prison are terrified of losing their parental rights, and I also spoke to children whose parents had their parental rights terminated, and what you've got to realize is that when your parents' parental rights are terminated as a child, you lose your right not only to your mom and your dad, but your grandma's not your grandma, your cousin isn't your cousin, your brother isn't your brother under the law. So that's a profound loss for children. And I know that Teresa Asokar, who raised the family that you were just speaking with, was terrified, as many grandmothers are, that at some point the Child Welfare Department was going to come and drop in and decide that something was wrong in the house and take those children. But, I mean, the Sentencing Project has done tremendous work around sentencing laws, and I think the law that has impacted children most is just sentencing laws themselves, which have been filling our prisons at record rates and have left us with incredibly high numbers of children impacted by parental incarceration overall.
Kara, what do we know, if anything, about whether there are any differences between parents who end up in jail and single people? I mean, are there any differences in, you know, the length of time that they go in, or are these, you know, just a regular slice of the whole prison population?
Well, the Bureau of Justice Statistics conducted a survey of inmates in 1999 and tried to look at who parents are who were incarcerated. The majority of parents who were incarcerated were African American. Many people who are parents had not graduated from high school. There's a disproportionate history of drug dependence and other health issues. And the reality is many of the people who go into prison, particularly for women, if they have children, they often don't have another partner who they can rely on to watch their child while they're incarcerated. They rely often on grandmothers and other relatives. And women prisoners actually are more likely to have a child who's cared for in the public welfare system.
When you think about the children, Nell, what kinds of symptoms do they have, you know, psychologically? It's got to be a form of grief and loss. So
yeah.
What kinds of things are the kids dealing with?
Yeah, I don't really think of it in terms of symptoms. What struck me most about the children was how similar their feelings were to those that I'd expect my children to feel were I to disappear from their lives suddenly. You know, and they talked a lot about, you know, Antoinette, used an expression that really haunted me. She described growing up feeling out of the circle, that people thought of her as different, when really their feelings of loss and grief and terror and sorrow and loneliness were very much akin to those any child would feel if a parent were spirited away in the middle of the night suddenly and didn't come back for 10 years. So that's really what struck me over and over, were just how similar their feelings were to those of any other child who had lost a parent for any other reason, whether that parent was shipped off to Iraq or taken out of their life because of a divorce. They're not different.
Just briefly, how does the group San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents try to deal with that?
Thanks for asking. We're a coalition. We don't provide support or services. We organize our efforts around a Bill of Rights for Children of Incarcerated Parents, which your listeners can access at www.sfcipp.org. And that's because in talking to children, which is the basis of our work, we realized that children have no rights within the multiple public systems, from police through courts, parole, probation, that are going to transform their lives so profoundly when their parents are arrested.
And let me get Kara in here before we end this. What would you like to see in terms of legislation or reform?
Well, there's a number of issues, particularly for individuals coming out of prison. One being mothers and fathers who come out of prison. There is federal law that encourages states to maintain bans on welfare assistance, including food stamps, TANF, public housing, and other items. And if parent is coming out of prison and they're trying to successfully transition from prison to caring for their children, if they don't have that safety net, the social safety net of public welfare benefits like TANF and food stamps, it's going to be much harder for them to take back custody of their children and to care for them. Well, and that's a real area we think there needs to be change in.
Okay. Kara, Nell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Nell Bernstein, author of All Alone in the World, Children of the Incarcerated, and Kara Gotch, the advocacy director at the Sentencing Project. She joined us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's Thursday, and time again for a look at the world of sports with our very own Tony Cox.
Hey, Farai.
Now, I know it's getting late in the NBA playoffs, and I understand that a lot of basketball fans are hoping for a Lakers-Celtics championship matchup.
Well, you know, that's right, actually, and it's a real possibility, in fact, now that the Lakers and Celtics are only one game away from the finals, but it's not over yet. It's one of the topics of my conversation this week with New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill.
The great Tony Cox.
How you doing, man?
How you doing, man?
Listen, before we get to the basketball playoffs, I want to talk about a column that you wrote this week in the New York Times looking at the subject of race in sports. And here's the background. Your piece was centered on the controversy surrounding the African-American manager of the New York Mets, Willie Randolph, whose team is in last place in the NL East and went into today's game with a so-so record of 26 wins and 27 losses. And the heat is really on his tail from the New York press. Is it racial? Randolph was asked in a recent interview. He then answered the question saying, quote, "It smells a little bit," end quote. Of course, that comment brought even more heat down on him, for which he later apologized. Now, Bill, here's what you wrote, quote, "In the post-Jeremiah Wright environment of racial etiquette, those who seek mainstream support, including managers and coaches, are loath to discuss hardcore racial realities and are encouraged to distance themselves from anyone who does." So when and where is the line drawn over discussing race as an issue?
Well, I mean, Tony, I think that people would rather you just not discuss it at all. I think, first of all, when you're winning, the Mets just won their second game in a row last night. So now all of a sudden there are happy smiles and the atmosphere is a little lighter because winning sort of cures things. But I think the underlying issue is this sort of lingering racial hostility, misunderstanding that exists between different racial groups. And I think it's crystallized in baseball, particularly where you have a large number of Latin players, significant number of African-American players, some white players, and, of course, an overwhelmingly white media. And I think that's when you begin to have the problems, because all these complex issues are being filtered through the prisms of a sort of Eurocentric press corps, which is overwhelmingly white, as I said, and really ill-equipped to critique itself and to look at things through other prisms. So when Willie Randolph talks about double standards, the first thing, oh, come on, Willie, what do you mean? you know what I mean? But, you know, too often the press, which I said is overwhelmingly white, is serving as judge, jury, and executioner. So there's no balance. So, and then, of course, the next day, you know, Willie apologized. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. I'm sorry.
And they moved on. Well, you know, here's how you closed your piece. Quote, "We like to talk about how much progress we've made. Let's not fool ourselves," end quote. Are you pessimistic or being realist?
I'm just being realistic, Tony. And that's based on, you know, living as long as we have lived. What is it? 5 decades?
I just think
that you have to be realistic. And I think that you don't have to go any further than our presidential race to realize that there are some really hardcore feelings about race and ethnicity that we just really have to deal with. But you don't deal with it, Tony, by not dealing with it, by not talking about it.
All right, let's move on to baseball. Actually, move on to basketball, I should say. We are seeing something that we haven't seen in quite a while. The two most famous franchises, the Los Angeles Lakers and the Boston Celtics, are in the conference finals, and it looks like they could meet for the championship beginning next week. A lot of people, writers included, want to see that for nostalgic reasons. That include you?
No, I just like to see, you know, great basketball. To be honest with you, I wouldn't mind seeing Detroit get into the finals against the Lakers. But, you know, that's the great thing about a 7-game series, Tony. The best team will win. Clearly, the Lakers are the best team in the West. Some people are saying they're the best team in basketball. The great thing about these playoffs from the East is finally seeing Kevin Garnett performing on this kind of stage, on a championship stage. I think that he's probably one of the three best players in the NBA right now. But, you know, I like Detroit, Tony. I like the way they play. I like their approach to the game. But you got to win a 7-game series.
You absolutely do. You know, the league admitted too late to help San Antonio, of course, that controversial no-call at the end of their playoff loss to the Lakers Tuesday was a mistake. And, you know, people are now saying that's evidence that they want the Lakers and Celtics to be in the final. But we're not going to go there again on that. Let's end with this. We've got less than a minute. Let's talk about the French Open. How are the Americans doing? I know James Blake is out now.
Blake is out, but the Williams sisters are in. You know, Venus and Serena are in. And I don't think Venus has ever won the French. I don't think either one of them has won the French. So, so far, so good. But you know, Justine Henin is tough. Rafael Nadal has never lost.
Roger Federer on the clay. That's just, you know, amazing to me.
I'd love to see one of the Williams sisters play. But they've got a really, really steep mountain to climb.
Now, Serena won the French back in, 2002? Am I right about that or no? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. No. I don't remember ever winning the French, but, you know, okay. Like I said, I'm in my 50s.
Having a senior moment. Bill Roden, it's always good to talk to you. We'll talk later after the NBA Finals.
All right, Tony, you take care.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with Bill Roden, a sports columnist for The New York Times and author of $40 Million Slaves, The Rise, Fall, and Redemption of the Black Athlete. Roden joined us from the NPR studios in New York. It's Thursday and time for letters. News and Notes' Tony Cox sat down with editor Sasha Woodruff to get a pulse on what listeners are saying.
Hey, Sasha.
Hey, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing great. So what are our folks saying this week?
Well, we got some letters about our series on criminal justice. Last week, we focused on issues surrounding the institution of prisons. Jessica Dawson in Northampton, Massachusetts, wrote us this.
As the partner of a person who has had the unfortunate experience of being stuck in the prison system, I can say with some experience that it is not a system which has been designed to rehabilitate its inmates or parolees. Going through the parole and probation system with my partner has opened my eyes to how insurmountable the obstacles to regaining an independent life can be after a period of incarceration. Thank you for shining some light on the issue.
Last week, we did a segment on gay marriage. We talked to writer Terrence Heath, who supports the legalization of same-sex unions. And to get perspective on the other side, we talked to Bishop Harry Jackson, who was against gay marriage. Listener Lena Wolf wrote in to say she didn't appreciate Jackson's comments.
Don't we hear enough of this bigotry in the mainstream media all the time? Would you consider airing the voice of a blatantly racist public figure on the show? I would think that would be too offensive, and rightfully so. Why not hold the same standard for homophobia? Honestly, the approach you've taken is not balanced journalism.
And finally, we got some heat for our weekly sports segment. Listener Jane Burton in St. Louis, Missouri, wrote in to say she wasn't a fan. I love Farai's clear and incisive questions and intelligent guests. I listen every evening. I'm so disappointed to hear 10 minutes worth of discussion about sports tonight. Has this been a regular feature? I expect more of you. Our poor quality local news in St. Louis frequently makes sports its main story, or worse, weather and crime. Please continue to focus on topics important to all of us. That's what we value about your program.
Well, thanks, Jane. And, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. We want to focus on topics important to all of us as well. And believe it or not, that includes sports for people who like to follow it. Come on, Jane, be open-minded. What happens in sports often mirrors what's happening in the rest of the world.
And that's it for letters. Thank you for your letters, and please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. When you get there, you'll see lots of shows to choose from. Make sure you pick News and Notes when you write to us.
And be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Thanks, Sasha.
No problem.
That was Tony Cox reading letters with editor Sasha Woodruff. That's our show for today, and thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, we finish our month-long series on the criminal justice system with a look at the death penalty.